What if everything you thought you knew about divine power was, well, completely wrong?
Or maybe just different.
Yeah, different. What if a god was burdened by their own power? Or maybe surprisingly cruel and just arbitrary? Today we're doing a deep dive into three really unique literary figures. Each one embodies a radically different idea of what it means to have godlike power.
We're going to be looking at Ursula K. Le Guin's classic, The Lathe of Heaven.
Oh, fantastic book.
And Frank Herbert's huge work, God, Emperor of Dune.
Another giant.
And also Robert Browning's really fascinating poem, Caliban upon Setebos.
Okay, so quite a mix there.
Definitely. It's a journey into how these authors, they don't just challenge the usual ideas of divinity, they kind of turn them inside out.
Right. So our mission today really is to unpack how these characters, these fictional beings, give us some surprising, maybe even paradigm-shifting insights into what it means for a powerful entity to shape reality.
Yeah, thinking about things like intention, control.
And interestingly, the ethics of not using power, of restraint.
Exactly. Get ready for, hopefully, some real aha moments.
Okay, let's get into it. Where should we start? Maybe with George Orr.
Sounds good. George Orr from Le Guin's The Lathe of Heaven.
Okay, so George, he isn't exactly a god in the way we normally think of one, right?
Not at all. But he has this incredible, almost terrifying ability. Effective dreams.
Effective dreams. Explain that a bit.
Well, whatever he dreams, it literally changes reality.
Yeah, it actually changes it.
Actually changes it, retroactively alters the past, reshapes the present. It's a seriously mind-bending concept to kick us off with.
Wow. Okay. So he dreams something, and the world changes to match the dream.
Precisely. And the kicker is, everyone else just accepts the new reality as if it always was. Only George remembers the previous version.
That sounds incredibly isolating.
It is. And that leads to the first big twist here. George is shown as this, you know, deeply human guy. He's morally grounded, and he is so reluctant about this power.
He doesn't want it.
He absolutely does not want it. He's burdened by it. He doesn't understand it. He tries to avoid dreaming effectively. He's really more like a vessel for change, almost passively, than some kind of intentional divine agent.
Which is such a stark contrast to the usual idea of an all-knowing, all-powerful god pulling the strings.
Totally. George even asks himself, you know, who am I to meddle with the way things go? That reluctance is key.
Okay, so why is that reluctance so central for Le Guin? What's the insight there?
Well, it's crucial because his humility, his passivity, it stands in direct opposition to another character, Dr. William Haber.
Ah, the psychiatrist.
Right. Haber discovers George's ability and tries to use it to manipulate George's dreams to create, you know, a perfect world, a utopia.
Sounds good in theory.
In theory. But every single attempt, every well-intentioned intervention by Haber, it just leads to these awful dystopian twists, unexpected consequences.
So George's dreams become a kind of metaphor.
Exactly. A metaphor for unintended consequences, especially like social and political ones. It's a huge warning against trying to play God, against thinking you can engineer perfection without massive downsides.
Okay, so let's dig into that aha moment you mentioned. If George is a kind of God figure, what kind is he?
He's this reluctant creator. Every act of creation, every reality shift is basically accidental and, for him, morally agonizing.
So inaction becomes a virtue.
In a way, yes. Divine inaction, or maybe passivity, isn't neglect here. It's almost a form of mercy. It suggests a model of divinity based on non-coercion, on empathy, on humility.
A god who refuses to dominate, even though they could wipe the slate clean with a dream.
Precisely. It's fascinating. He represents a kind of fallible omnipotence.
Fallible omnipotence. I like that. Powerful, but not all-knowing, not totally in control.
Right. And that completely challenges the idea of a perfect creation or some grand preordained master plan. The universe that comes from his dreams is messy, imperfect, full of unintended consequences.
Kind of like our own world.
Exactly like our own world.
And you mentioned he remembers the past realities.
Yes, that's crucial too. He's a god entangled in the world. He carries the trauma, the memory, the guilt of these changes that no one else even knows happen.
That sounds like, well, like a kind of suffering.
It is. And it aligns with some theological ideas, like process theology, where God isn't just distant and static, but is actually within the universe, evolving with it, maybe even suffering alongside creation. George becomes this sort of wounded god.
Wow. And the fact that it's dreams doing the creating.
Yeah, his subconscious dream-based creation, it subtly undermines purely rationalistic ideas about God and reality. It suggests reality itself might be more like a mutable dreamscape than some fixed logical machine.
And his resistance to Haber, the guy trying to force utopia.
Right, his resistance suggests that maybe salvation, or just goodness, isn't found in total control or forced perfection. Maybe it's in acceptance, endurance, just being present.
Like the quote says, being nothing but himself is everything.
That sums it up perfectly. He embodies a theology of limits, empathy, humility, a God who honors freedom, even messy freedom, over absolute control.
Okay, wow. That's a powerful, kind of gentle vision of divinity, despite the chaotic results.
Very much so.
So we've explored George Orr, the reluctant dreamer god. Now, prepare for whiplash.
Yeah.
Let's take a complete philosophical U-turn.
Uh-oh.
Frank Herbert's God, Emperor of Dune, and Leto II the Treatise.
Raya, talk about a different vision of godlike power.
Totally different. Leto II is, well, he declares himself God Emperor. He rules for millennia, consciously designing and forcing through this vast, incredibly painful plan, the Golden Path.
All designed, he claims, to save humanity from stagnation and ultimate extinction. His godhood is strategic, it's terrifyingly foresighted, and it's utterly deliberate. No reluctance here.
Not at all. And what's really striking is the sheer weight of that total control he embraces.
Oh, absolutely. He embraces omnipotence, omniscience, or its closest makes no difference. And he imposes suffering, scarcity, enforced peace, stagnation, really, on humanity for thousands of years.
All for its long-term survival, according to him.
According to him, he acts decisively, coercively. His divinity is, you could say, managerial, authoritarian, and deeply utilitarian.
Utilitarian meaning.
The greatest good for the greatest number, even if the means are brutal. He genuinely believes that human free will, in the short term, has to be crushed to ensure the species survives in the long term.
He has that chilling line, doesn't he? A lesson their bones would remember.
Exactly. When I set out to lead humankind along my golden path, I promised them a lesson their bones would remember. That sums up his approach. Pain as a teacher on a species-wide scale.
And he's not exactly relatable, is he? He becomes this human sandworm hybrid.
Right, he physically transforms over millennia. His consciousness becomes post-human. He is truly wholly
You're
other,
failing needed.
completely, inspiring fear, awe, worship, but ruling from this immense distance, emotionally, morally, physically severed from the humanity he's trying to save. He literally is the environment, the controlling force.
Which brings up some deeply uncomfortable questions about the ethics of it all. Redemptive tyranny, you called it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. His philosophy is pretty much pure utilitarianism mixed with Machiavellianism. The ends absolutely justify the means.
So violent control is ethical if it prevents something worse down the line.
That's his argument. He sees himself almost as a kind of Nietzschean over God, someone beyond conventional morality who has to embrace cruelty and sacrifice to birth a stronger, more resilient humanity. It's a terrifyingly paternalistic vision.
And it's all geared towards the future.
Entirely. His vision is completely teleological,
Gimme.
focused on the end goal. Everything in the present, all the suffering, is shaped for a specific, distant future outcome. He sees himself as the author of humanity's timeline, deliberately creating this historical bottleneck to force adaptation and then unleash humanity later, changed.
So a kind of eschatological divinity, focused on the ultimate destiny.
Precisely. Leto acts because he believes he has to. There's no choice in his view. He embodies this God of necessity, remaking humanity through calculated visionary pain.
Wow. Okay, so the absolute polar opposite of George Orr.
Couldn't be more different. George struggles against imposing his will. Leto imposes his will on an unimaginable scale, believing it's the only way.
Imposing purpose through pain versus accidental creation and the pain of consequence.
You got it.
All right. We've got the reluctant god and the necessary tyrant. Let's take another sharp turn. Robert Browning's poem, Caliban Upon Setebos.
Ah, Setebos. Now we're going somewhere really primal.
Yeah, tell us about this Caliban, who we know from Shakespeare's The Tempest, right? The sort of monstrous servant figure.
That's the one. In Browning's poem, Caliban is just speculating about his god, Setebos, and significantly, he bases his entire idea of God on his own experience.
Which is mostly.
Suffering, fear, and the arbitrary power of his master, Prospero.
Okay. So what kind of God does Caliban imagine?
He imagines Setebos as cruel, inconsistent, moody, and totally unconcerned with morality or fairness.
Sounds pleasant.
Deeply unpleasant. This god acts purely on whim, does things because it feels like it, likes to cause pain sometimes, is indifferent other times. It mirrors exactly what Caliban sees in the harshness of nature and the often cruel behavior of Prospero.
So Browning is making a point here about how we create gods in our own image, or maybe in the image of our oppressors.
Exactly. It's a really profound insight. Browning is critiquing how theology, or just our concept of the divine, often reflects our own social position, our fears, our experiences of power or powerlessness. Caliban thinks, quite literally, he hath a spite against me, that I know. It's personal projection.
It sounds like that idea from Feuerbach, that God is often a projection of human psychology.
Very much aligns with that. Ctebos is basically divine power stripped bare of any ethical consciousness, any plan, any benevolence. It's just raw power seen through the eyes of someone who suffers under it. A brutal, thoughtless echo of the creature's own fears.
A God shaped by the experience of being powerless.
That's it, exactly. Ctebos is what power looks like to the powerless.
Mm.
Arbitrary, amoral, frighteningly indifferent.
Okay, so that adds a really important third dimension. Not just reluctant power or necessary power, but power perceived as sheer random force.
Right, it completes a kind of triangle, showing how divinity can be imagined not just as benevolent or strategic, but also as a reflection of pure suffering and fear.
So we have these three incredible, radically different literary figures. George Orr, Leto II, and Caliban's Ctebos. Let's try and pull them together a bit, compare them side by side.
Okay. Let's look at their core divine power first.
Yeah.
Ctebos. Arbitrary, cruel, indifferent whim. George Orr, unwilled power, often repressed, ethically restrained, almost accidental. Leto II, deliberate, calculated, sacrificial, visionary control aimed at a specific outcome.
And their moral orientation. That seems key.
Hugely different. Ctebos is basically amoral. Morality doesn't enter the picture. No. George Orr represents ethical restraint, humility, almost a kind of divine nonviolence, you could say.
Right.
And Leto II embodies a brutal utilitarianism, a philosophy of sacrificial necessity for what he defines as the greater long-term good.
Ends justify the means.
Pretty much.
And how they relate to creation, to the world they influence.
Also distinct, Ctebos seems to see creation as just play, or maybe a target for torment. It's capricious. George Orr experiences his impact on reality as a burden, a trauma, something he accidentally causes and feels responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
Leto II sees creation, or rather humanity, as a project. What? Something to be governed, designed, sculpted, even if it hurts.
This really brings up a huge question, doesn't it? Does moral divinity lie in acting, in intervening, maybe even forcefully like Leto? Or is it found in refraining, in holding back like George?
That's maybe the central tension here. George represents something like maybe the Taoist idea of Wu Wei, effortless action or non-interference, or maybe even Simone Weil's idea that God is withdrawal, letting be.
Allowing freedom, even if it's chaotic.
Right. Whereas Leto embodies purposeful divine governance, like an Old Testament lawgiver, maybe, or Plato's philosopher king imposing order.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who takes charge, structures things, like the kind of ordered power you might associate with Aquinas' view of God.
And Ctebos.
Ctebos just throws a wrench in that whole debate. It shows divinity as simply a projection of fear, a reflection of human suffering, like Feuerbach argued. Power without purpose or morality.
So thinking about the classic problem of evil, or theodicy.
Yeah.
Why is there suffering? These figures give us different answers.
They really do. In George's world, suffering seems to be the often unintended price of freedom, of a reality that isn't rigidly controlled. It's chaotic, but morally free, in a sense.
Okay.
In Leto's world, suffering is deliberately imposed. It's a tool, a necessary evil used to prevent annihilation and force evolution. It's ordered, but ethically coercive.
And in Caliban's world,
suffering is just arbitrary torment. It happens because Ctebos feels like it. There's no reason, no greater good. It's just the whim of a cruel power.
Chilling. And all this has huge implications for human agency, for freedom.
Absolutely. Le Guin's vision, through George, ultimately protects human agency because the god restrains himself. Herbert's vision, through Leto, explicitly sacrifices agency on the altar of species survival. It really challenges our democratic ideals.
And Browning's.
Browning, through Caliban, shows us the psychological impact of powerlessness, how it shapes our view of everything, including God. It reveals this raw fear of the unknown, of forces beyond our control.
You know, this isn't just literary analysis, is it? It feels really relevant.
I think so, too. This comparison isn't just about fiction. It helps us ask questions about our own world. What kind of power do we fear? What kind of restraint do we value? What kind of authority or even gods do we imagine or maybe even create in our own societies?
Yeah, like thinking about about technology or government control or paternalism.
Exactly. These stories act like lenses. They help us question things like technocratic authority, the impulse for total control versus the value of freedom, even messy freedom.
So putting it all together, we've got George Orr's humble, reluctant coexistence with power. We've got Leto II's messianic, forceful imposition of a grand plan, and Caliban's vision of power as just brutal, arbitrary force.
It's a huge spectrum, isn't it? A really rich exploration of how power, responsibility, and the divine can be imagined. These authors are doing more than telling stories. They're asking profound questions.
Well, it's just like, if divinity means shaping reality, is it better to step in, even if it causes pain like Leto? Or is it better, maybe more loving, to withdraw like George and allow freedom, even if it leads to chaos?
Right. Is ultimate control the highest form of power? Or is profound, empathetic restraint the true mark of wisdom, maybe even divinity?
So the final thought for you listening, what stands out? In our world, where we grapple constantly with how much control is too much, how much government intervention is right, how much freedom is essential, which of these gods offers a vision that resonates?
Or maybe frightens you, which reflects the powers you see at play. Which vision, if any, might you want to live under? Or perhaps even aspire to embody in how you use your own influence?
Lots to think about there. This deep dive really encourages you, I think, to keep exploring these big questions on your own.